myself. We lived together, not only in the same building, but along the same hallways, sometimes in adjoining suites, sometimes sharing the same bathrooms and shower rooms. That person would have been looked at, as if his eyebrows had been eaten away like weevils. What is it going on? Well, it's just part of the, it's like I-95. It's like I made it, it's there. Everything I did here, a little home.
Predators more or less happy.
into more trouble than they did. We really got into, there was very little change at all in that great, great program. But the crashes, believe me, were there. There were representatives, for example, of Ursula Andress. Do you remember her, the Swedish who were determined to get an inflatable Ursula Andress doll onto a moon flight. They had his pressure on Pete Conrad. He was the commander of Apollo 12, second mission to the moon. And these people were persistent. My friend Singer, I think her name was Yvette Pompier, did manage to get a CD, or rather a tape cassette of her songs onto one of the Apollo flights by somehow ingratiating himself with the representative with a technician. Astronauts were allowed to take up tapes of their favorite music to play during these long missions. And the last thing on this astronaut's mind was what music he was going to take when he was playing. So he picked up his tape cassette and here was French songs. Anyway, there was one thing after another. One of the richest, though, I think, was Apollo 14. The commander, Alan Shepard, may God rest his soul. Alan Shepard decided he was going to hit the longest golf drive in the history of golf, because he was going to drive a golf ball on the moon where the gravity is 1/6 of what it is on Earth. He had this special collapsible golf club made. And he had an approved golf ball that he brought up. They had only been 1 cent on board. And he had an approved tee that he carried up. Basically, he was blowing the dark. And this was going to be, he could see, Mark and I were talking about the fact that you really do need ego to do something like that. God bless astronauts with egos, too. He was going to make headlines everywhere, all over the world, wherever golf was played, people could be at that game. The longest golf drive in all of history. What he didn't know was that there was another astronaut on that flight who had an interesting project in mind. His name was Edgar Mitchell. I think the only astronaut that had a doctorate from MIT. Edgar Mitchell was convinced, and he may still be convinced, and he might as well be wrong, that there is such a thing as telepathy, transmitting messages through kinetic mind power across the great voids from one person to another. So he had gone on to the flight, not with a collapsible golf club, or an especially approved golf ball, or a moon team. And he had four little cards, which people interested in ESP use to try to see if they could communicate in symbols to one another. The way you could is you stare at the symbol, I forget what the four symbols are, but they're rather basic. And you stare at the symbol, and then you concentrate your mind as hard as you can and you try to project to the person who's receiving the message. So each one of his rest periods, he would take out a card, all four cards. He had four people on Earth who were waiting to receive these messages. These transmissions from space. And so during his rest period, he'd take out his temple and he'd concentrate. run this experiment from space. Not a newspaper or a television channel in America was interested in Alan Shepard's God drive. He did that all. And it was the longest God drive in all of history. But all of what people wanted to know about was ESP from space. with Eddie Mitchell. I'm not sure that Alan Shepard ever forgave Eddie Mitchell for that. NASA then sort of scratched its collected head and said, is this a violation of a pilot's protocol in space? The more they thought about it, the more they realized that how can you call it a violation of the landing of a little car down in the pocket of his spacesuit and things? So, Eddie Mitchell was fine, standing was fine. I don't know. Of course, that was toward the end of the program. It wasn't too likely that he was going to go over the road. But it was going to go over again anyway. I think he may have jeopardized his chances at that point. But it was an absolutely fabulous program. But unfortunately, I really do think this was a misfortune. NASA never had a real publicly presented philosopher. And the day came when NASA badly needed a philosopher to explain to the country what the space program is all about. No one needed an outlook, a philosophy, an argument at the beginning of the space program. The beginning, the idea was that this is the life and death battle against the Soviets. And Lyndon Johnson talked about the high ground of space. And everybody, not one of them, had the impression that the Russians are going to be flying around in these satellites of theirs. And they're going to be dropping missiles. No, there goes Chernobyl. There goes Boise. And then it'll be the simplest thing in the world. You just fly around and drop these things wherever you want. But in fact, of course, that is probably the most complicated way imaginable to hit a target. Because you get into what I think is known in mathematics as the three-body problem. You've got a moving spacecraft going around the Earth. And you've got the Earth itself is moving, and the missile is moving. And as I understand, it's extremely hard to solve that particular problem. But anyway, at the outset, all that was needed was the realization that it was terribly important that we catch up with the Soviet in space. When John Glenn became the first American to go into orbit, after the Soviets had shown us up, in a sense, by having two-man flights for overhead, Alan Shepard, I think, went on one, two, anyway. His going up into space, into orbit, was looked upon as David challenging Goliath. It really was what is known in ancient history as single combat. You have your two great warriors fight it out, which represents somehow the fate of an entire nation. John Glenn was looked upon as a military hero. And when he returned to Earth and went on his tropical tour and had the ticket tape parade in New York City, he was looked upon as a protector who had saved us from oblivion at the hands of obliteration rather than the hands of the Soviet Union. that part of the space program was beginning in 1963 when the hotline was established between Washington and Moscow. And no longer was there, did there seem to be imminent threat of nuclear war. And at that point, the space program became more of a scientific experiment. And for that reason, I think that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins, when they returned to Earth from Apollo 11, the first mission to the moon, they were not seen as heroes. I don't think anybody broke into tears because these men were coming by in a parade. They were considered very brave, and they were the ones who had been in the center of a tremendous technical accomplishment, much of which was had been built in this very city. But they were not, they were no longer seen as defenders of the United States. Well, as time went by, the budgets began to be cut back very sharply. And they began to be cut back as soon as we reached them, as soon as Neil Armstrong stepped on the surface of the moon. That was the beginning of tremendous reduction in funding for the space program. And it seems appealing to me that by now we have not had a manned mission to Mars. With all their drawing boards, you can't just think in a year and go to Mars. You have to wait for the planets to align themselves in a certain way. But at that point, the Congress and other people, the public general, began to regard the space program as pretty much the way Spaniards had regarded Columbus's voyages. You know, Columbus made four voyages to the New World. And after the fourth one, after even the fourth one brought back no gold, no slaves, the Carrying Indians, who Columbus wanted to bring back this thing that slaves would inevitably die on board ship rather than in the voyage. All they were able to bring back was cotton at a time when there was a glut on the cotton market in Europe. Well, after six voyages to the moon, NASA was in somewhat the same situation. The moon rocks had not proved to be all that interesting. There was nothing much else there on the moon. It was at that point that I think NASA very badly needed a philosopher. And NASA had a philosopher, and he lived in this city. His name was Werner von Braun. But it was very difficult for NASA to present a foreign member of the German Wehrmacht as its spokesman at a time when a spokesman was critically needed. It was von Braun who I managed to meet later in his life, who made what to me is the most exciting argument about the exploration of space. He said, one day the sun will die. The sun is a burning star, and we are in its magnetic field. But one day that's going to burn out. And we cannot let that happen and have mankind exterminated with it. Because as far as we know, and you can make all the objections you want, but as far as we know, the only sentient, thinking, feeling creatures in the entire cosmos are here on Earth. that day comes, and it will come, that it's decided that we should have another great national effort like the one together to run in the first place. Actually, all that NASA needs for this tremendous comeback is for an unmanned vehicle to find any life in the rest of the cosmos at all. Something the size of a gnat will do. The whole world galvanized. Just one living thing is found. Let me prove to be a far-fetched hope. I, for one, would love. I just incidentally, NASA never simply dismisses out of hand unidentified flying objects. You'll notice that the response usually is well. Many of our astronauts have literally seen objects that could not be identified. I think that it has become a double-edged and part of it's got two-track thinking. Part of the mind says, well, that there have been no unidentified objects. But another part says, well, let's keep the prospect alive. Who knows exactly what it's up there? In any case, that is my, and it's a great satisfaction to me to be able to present my idea of a new picture for the space program here in Huntsville. Listen, it's been absolutely wonderful. It's a great privilege for me to be able to be here with you. And I just can't thank you all remarkable enough. Thanks.
Devoted to his religious side, and